In general, I have no problem responding to queries during my talk. The give and take while we're doing something, especially as we're going to be reading a text, is perfectly okay. So if some of you would like to interject or ask as we go along, I imagine we should not have any difficulty with it. I will come back to the text that I'm going to talk about shortly, but let me begin by setting the stage as follows. What do we know about biblical commentaries? We are accustomed, I think, all of us, to open up a Mikraot Gedolot and to look at Rashi, Rashbam, Ramban, Ibn Ezra, or others, and to read commentaries which are geared to flow along with the text. Difficult pasuk, we look in the commentary, Dibur HaMatchil, followed by a comment or a remark, Rashi making a comment of his own or quoting a midrash, commentaries upon commentaries. And if we don't think about it, it's probably very easy for us to make a presumption that as it is, so it always was, that there have always been written commentaries on Torah or on Tanakh. Going back as far as Tanakh has been studied by Jews from the day after Matan Torah, that they were studying Tanakh with some form of a written commentary. Actually, when we begin to look more closely at the question, and we say to ourselves, historically, where can we locate, where can we find our earliest biblical commentary, we actually find that it isn't so easy. If you go back, let's say, to the period of late Bayit Sheni, and we look for commentaries, and by commentary, I mean something other than a translation. There's no doubt, and one of my own areas of interest happens to be the Targumim, but I'm not talking about commentaries in the form of consecutive translation of a text. Because all translations, of course, are commentaries, but we can't... a commentary which is limited, even the expanded Eretz Yisrael Targumim, which sometimes have a little bit of Midrash added, they are limited by the shape and form of the text of the Torah. I'm talking about commentaries which move away from literal translation and comment on the text, using the text as a springboard, using the text as an object of analysis. And actually, if we look to find the earliest commentaries, we probably find them even before the Midrash in the form that we find it, and I'll talk about that in a moment. We find them with Philo of Alexandria, the well-known Jewish thinker of the late 1st century BCE, 1st century CE, who wrote a series of philosophical commentaries on Torah, basing himself not on the Hebrew text, but on the text which he knew, the so-called Targum HaShivim, or the Septuagint. And in the context of using this translation, he wrote a allegorical interpretation, not suggesting, incidentally, that people not do mitzvot. Philo is very much in favor of people doing mitzvot, but interpreting the Torah in light of the philosophical system which he in Hellenistic Alexandria followed. This was not a commentary which was searching for Pshuto Shel Mikra, which, of course, is one of the primary goals that we have, at least that many of us have, in our study of Torah Shebichtav. The same thing might be said some generations later. When we look at Chazal, we look at the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud, as well as the Midrash, and we look into their compositions, which we might call commentaries, whether the ones that we call Midrashei Halacha, such as the Mechilta, the Sifra, the Sifrei, which perhaps begin to be composed in written form or in some form in the, let's say, the 3rd century of the Common Era, or the so-called Midrashei Agadah, the Midrashim, which focus not on halachic issues, but on retelling of the story, interpretation of the stories of Torah, beginning, let's say, with Breshit Rabbah, which might be, let's say, 6th century of the Common Era, as well as all the Midrashim that follow them. In none of these cases will we find Chazal looking for Pshuto Shel Mikra. We don't find that in most cases. Here and there we might find a comment in a Breishit Rabbah kind of midrash, which is focusing on a question of what does this text actually mean. More often, we are going to get comments of what we would call an agadic nature, using the text as a springboard for expressing ideas, for interpreting the text by filling in its gaps, and expressing the worldview, the ideology of Chazal. But Pshuto Shel Mikra is not to be found there, or indeed, as I said, in the commentaries of Philo. We actually, for Jewish biblical commentary, virtually have to skip to the medieval period, beginning with Rav Saadia Gaon, probably among Jews, to find the first attempt to write a commentary on Torah from the standpoint of Pshat, from the standpoint of trying to elucidate the fundamental meaning of the text, and not merely to juggle and move about rabbinic midrashim. And of course, once Saadia begins, and later on, perhaps a bit more than a century later, when Rashi begins in Franco-Germany, the great schools of Pashtanim of the Middle Ages have begun. Actually, among non-Jewish students of Tanakh, we can find Pshat commentary even earlier. Some of the early church writers, whether the ones who wrote in Greek or in other languages, were at times interested in what we would call Pshat interpretation or simple sense interpretation. How did then... Yes, please. Yes. There's no doubt that this is certainly true. And Rav Saadia Gaon is responding to the Karaites. I was being narrow-minded. You're correct. There certainly the Karaites, who focus so closely on Torah Shebichtav and its meaning, the Karaites indeed did write commentaries of what we would call a Pshuto Shel Mikra nature. Certainly, someone like Yefet Ben Ali and others are very much concerned with Pshat and. In a certain sense, we owe to them some of the stimulus for our own medieval commentaries. How did biblical interpretation get written up in the earliest period then, back in the time of, let's say, Bayit Sheni? And what's interesting is that at the time of Bayit Sheni, and I'm talking about before we know anything about the discoveries at Qumran of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I'll come to them in a moment, but the earliest biblical interpretation of which we can talk is the rewriting of the biblical story with the interpretation included. That is to say, I would take the biblical text and I would retell the narrative. One example of this would be the historian of the first century CE, Josephus, who in the first 11 books of his Jewish antiquities retells the story of Tanakh. He may leave things out, he may add things, he may adjust things, but actually, what is he doing? He's writing an interpretation of Tanakh via the rewriting. Through the retelling of the story, he's giving you his views on the meaning of the stories in Tanakh, the narratives, and even the halachot and even the laws in some case. Likewise, a book like Sefer HaYovlim, Book of Jubilees, which actually probably comes out of circles very closely related to the people who lived at Qumran near the Dead Sea, the author of the Book of Jubilees retells the story from creation through Yitziat Mitzrayim, the stories of the Avot, adding a great deal of halachic material to his retelling, telling stories which we might call midrashic about some of the adventures of the Avot, some of which have parallels in Chazal, some of them don't have parallels in Chazal in our own traditional retellings in Midrash. But the reinterpretation of the text, and this is what I think is key, the way that you comment on the text is by retelling the story. In other words, they haven't found a short way to do it. The only way to do it is to write the whole story over again with your own interpretation mixed in and put in. Later on, by the way, in the late medieval period, you get certain compositions like this from early medievals or late rabbis of the classical period, something like Sefer HaYashar, for example, which is a retelling, midrash included, of the stories of Sefer Breishit and Shemot. We have a running narrative. It's as if retelling in Yiddish we would say verteicht und verbessert, miturgam umishupar. The The story, however, is retold, and the interpretation is built in to the retelling. Now, let me ask a question. Maybe some of you are thinking of this question yourselves. Why do we care how people were reading Tanakh during Bayit Sheni? Why is it of interest to us how some group of Jews somewhere is focusing on the biblical text and in extracting meaning from it? Jews who really have nothing to do with us, they don't seem to be our spiritual ancestors. They were living at the same time as some of our spiritual ancestors. But why are we concerned with it? And I think the simplest answer to that, at least the answer with which I prefer and with which I like to work, is the notion that it is via our reading of some of this material that we can understand better the nature of, and I'm going to use the term in quotation marks, I don't mean it literally, Torah Sheba'al Peh. That is to say, how Jews traditionally have understood some of these texts, going back even before to the pieces that we have recorded in Chazal. Sometimes the interpretation will match Chazal, sometimes they won't, but very often we can get a sense of a communal and common shared interpretive experience among Jews during Bayit Sheni, which eventually narrows and focuses, of course, in the rabbinic tradition later on, the tradition out of which we all derive. But even by reading texts written at times by some of the opponents of our spiritual ancestors, we may very well get light shed, both perhaps indirectly and directly, on the way in which Torah was studied. And I think as Jews, the understanding of how Torah has been studied through the ages is something which ought to interest us very, very much. Let me say a few words about the Dead Sea Scrolls, and let it be only a few, because if I start talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls, we're never going to get to our text. Let me just ask, is there anybody who is completely unfamiliar with the Dead Sea Scrolls sitting here? Do you all know something? Good. If you don't, please raise your hand. I don't want to presume too much. You all know there were texts found in caves, and these texts come from a bunch of Jews who lived in or near those caves in the late Second Temple period, let's say 2nd century BCE through the beginning of the 1st century CE. They weren't monks. They had nothing to do with early Christianity. So if you believe those Baba Mises, I'll give you another lecture some other time. But we know that these are Jews who practiced halakha in their own way, very, very devoutly practiced halakha, and they spent a great deal of their time studying Torah, both halakha as well as other things, and they left us a very large library by accident. And there's a lot of debate now, which I would not want to get into at this point, of just where is this library coming from, whose is it. Let's suffice it to say it's the library of the people that lived at Qumran, but not everything in it needs to have been written by the people who lived at Qumran. And I'm going to use Qumranites and Dead Sea sects synonymously. If I say Essenes, you can call them that too, although maybe that's not the word I'd want to use. I'm going to prefer Qumranites because it locates them where they lived. And their library can be divided into three broad categories. One, Sifrei Tanakh themselves. Many, many Sifrei Tanakh. Texts of Torah, texts of Nevi'im, texts of Ketuvim, every book of Tanakh has been found at Qumran in pieces. And when we talk about found, you know, we shouldn't call them the Dead Sea Scrolls. We should call them the Dead Sea Fragments, because most of what we find are bits and pieces. I mean, there's a 2-inch by 4-inch piece, which if it had gotten lost, I would have to say that Divrei HaYamim is not found at Qumran, because there's one piece, 2 inches by four, and that's the all of Divrei HaYamim that you find. The only book that's missing is Esther, and as you know, there is a debate as to whether or not it's an accident or not. I don't think it's an accident. They had a very funny calendar at Qumran, a very strange calendar, and according to their calendar, Purim would always come out on Shabbat. They couldn't have that. There's no doubt that, I believe anyway, and I'm not the only one who thinks this, that Esther is excluded at Qumran because of their very strong calendrical feelings that you can't have a yontif like that falling out on Shabbat. Their calendar didn't let any Yamim Tovim fall out on Shabbat. So first we have Tanakh, we have Bible. Second, we have books that belong to the broad literature of Bayit Sheni, that every Jewish home you might go into, not just a cave, might have had a copy of some of these books, I don't mean every Jewish home, on their shelves. So general literature not specifically oriented to the unique beliefs, customs, and practices of the people that lived at Qumran. But, you know, Sfarim that were making the rounds during Bayit Sheni. And the third group, of course, are the uniquely sectarian documents, the texts which carry the beliefs, the customs, and the practices, the Sifrei Halakha that they wrote down, the calendars that told them when to observe the Chagim, which of course was a calendar different from the one that the Prushim were observing, and the texts which talk about the war which is going to take place, Bacharit HaYamim, in the end of days, which is about to happen between the Bnei Or and the Bnei Choshech. And of course, they're the Bnei Or, and our ancestors would have been the Bnei Choshech, but doesn't always work out the way they write it in the books. And we're here and they're not. And the fact is that there is this very, very strong messianic eschatological belief that they're living in Acharit HaYamim and that things are going to happen and there's going to be an upheaval in the world. As I said, they are very interested in Tanakh. And over the years, from the very earliest discoveries, which basically go back to 1947, Tanakh has been in the forefront. In that very first cave, there are two scrolls of Yeshayahu, very famous texts. There's also, of those first seven manuscripts, there's a text called it's called in Hebrew, for no better reason, the Megillah Chitzona Livreishit. In English, it's called the Genesis Apocryphon. It's a half Targum, half Midrash kind of work. It tells, we have material about Noah, we have material about Avram. It breaks off in the middle, so we don't know how far it would have gone. But it's a fascinating work, written in Aramaic, not in Hebrew, written in Aramaic. And it's very rich in the kind of interpretation, both what we would call pshat, as well as what we would call drash. But after all, it's not chazal, so maybe we shouldn't call it drash, but it's drash anyway. In addition, there is other interpretive material. There are commentaries on the Nevi'im. And because they believed they were living in Acharit HaYamim, their commentaries on the Nevi'im reflected that belief. They left us commentaries called psharim, Peshin Resh, to interpret. That's a word that occurs once in the Hebrew part of Tanakh and once, I think, in the Aramaic. Mike chacham umiyodea pesher davar is a pasuk in Kohelet. Who is the wise man and who knows the interpretation of the thing or word? And they call their interpretations psharim, and they explain the words of the Nevi'im how they pertain to their own day. And again, we could spend a lot of time talking about it, but we'll have to leave that for another time. They were very actively involved in the study of Mikra, in the study of Torah Shebichtav. A text was published some years ago, and I'm not going to go through the history of the publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls. This one is related, actually, to some of the scandalous aspect, because when I first read this text, not in an official publication, but in the edition which was reconstructed by computer based on a concordance, which is a list of all the words that is in a text, and you then have to sort of juggle it around with a computer program and you end up with the text, and it was published with a great deal of criticism by two scholars who both of whom happen to be friends of mine. And I opened it up and I started to read it and I said, this is remarkable. This is unlike any other commentary or perush or interpretation of Bible that I know from the ancient world. And I sat down and I began to think about it and to read it and to comment. Now we'll turn our attention to the focus of our discussion. I put together here a few copies. There's no need for people to hold and have these, but I put together a few facsimiles, just so you should see what it looks like. This is bigger than reality. I'll pass a couple of these around. There's one major piece. Put a couple more out there. Just so you can take a look and see what it is. This is actually a better copy, even though it's small. Pass around and take a look. You'll see there's a total of, I think, five or six pieces. If anybody wants, I've got more, but I think of the smaller fragments, I only have one. Here, a couple of just the larger one. The large one is bigger than life size, I think. You take the text, you'll see it has one very big chunk at the beginning, and a little piece, and then the other page, I've given out all the pictures of the other page. The other page has about three or four smaller fragments on it. These, by the way, are published in the last issue, a couple of issues back in Jewish Quarterly Review. These facsimiles were published. They're not pirated or stolen in any way. Some of the smaller ones you may actually be able to read. In fact, you know, one of these is very, very readable. Maybe I should have passed this around. But you look at a text that has six pieces, let's say, and you realize that they're going to belong together. Brief comments. You have this, you have these. Here's the big piece, and then here you have the smaller pieces. Now, it begins in the middle of a sentence, and everybody, I and others who were working on this text, said there must be some material before. There must have been some more parchment over on this side. And after I had published an article about this text, and I got it in galleys, and I was just reading it for errors, I got a communication from my colleague George Brook, who is the official editor of this text, saying, there's no doubt that column one is really column one, because if you look on the back, there's a place on the back of the scroll, or the first column, where you can see the marking of the leather thong that was used to tie around it, and where the leather string was attached, you can see it right on the back of the first column. And you can then actually see the crack in the back following along the line of this leather thong, so you know it was wrapped around the outside, which means we're going to have to explain it some other way, but column one is really column one. And you start with column one, and you can actually put together, this piece goes down below, but let's see. This piece here, and you can see the beginning of column three. You got column one and part of column two, and you got a few words up there from column three. Now you can take those beginning words of column three and match them up with this piece, which has the end of the lines of column three. Of course, there's a big chunk in the middle that's missing. And here I've got column four. Now, if I remember correctly, this goes down here, and this piece now can be stuck out on the other end. So in effect, we only have pieces of this text, but we know that we have a series of consecutive columns, because by beginning and ends of lines, you know that the subject matter works across. And by the way, this is an area where a great deal of thanks has to be given to those scholars who do this work, whether they are Ohavei Yisrael or they're not, people like Joseph Millick and John Strugnell, both of whom are terrible anti-Semites, but are very, very good readers of manuscripts. And credit has to be given where credit is due. But we know that we have something fairly whole. Could we argue that how much further it went? Maybe I'll come to that towards the end of our discussion. But certainly, we have the beginning and a good deal of consecutive material after it. But this text doesn't come with a title. Texts from the ancient world don't come with titles on top of them, or with authors on top of them. And one of the problems that we always have is, how do you go about approaching a text which is brand new, which you don't even know what kind of a text it is, no author, no genre, no title page, no beginning some of the time. Here we're lucky we have the beginning. The only names we have are the names given by the earliest editors. And in this particular case, they called it Pesher Genesis, and they were wrong, because that's a loaded name. Pesher is a technical term for a certain kind of Achrit HaYamim interpretation. And whereas it might characterize one little piece of this manuscript, it's a bad characteristic for the whole, which is why George Brook, and with my strong agreement, has changed its name to Genesis Commentary A. There are three others, B, C, D, and D. Even the fact that we found this text in the caves at Qumran can prejudice the way we read it. And this is one of the major points of dispute between Brook and myself. I look at a text and I say, let me read the text. Let me not worry about where the text came from. I want the text to tell me what it is. He said, but I found it at Qumran. I'm going to look at it through the eyes of all the other literature which I know from Qumran. And I said, you're wrong. Okay, well, he's my good friend, and we've agreed to disagree rather strongly about this particular manuscript. The way I've divided up the text in the translation that I've put before you is artificial, and I want to stress this because the material that I'm going to talk about is the material where we can read big pieces of text. the interim material, and you do have all of it in Brooks' reconstruction. I mean, if you just take a quick look at the second page of the Hebrew, I am not going to be talking about the last four or five lines, or maybe last four lines of column two. I'm not going to be talking virtually at all about column three, except maybe to note what material is there. Column four, I'll have something to say, and column five. But you have to realize how much there is that we're missing, and I want to stress it and admit that I'm arguing on the basis of what we do have and not on the basis of what we don't have. So that maybe if we had more, I'd have to adjust my remarks. But I can, Ein l'dayan ela ma she'einav ro'ot, the judge has to act on the basis of the evidence in front of him, and that's what we have, and that's what I mean by the Dead Sea Fragments. Please be aware, this is the dilemma that we are always going to face. On the translation which I gave you, anything which is bracketed is material that's found in gaps that I filled in here and there on the basis of that. Now, what I'd like to do, as a student of biblical interpretation of Parshanut HaMikra, I'd like to read through the commentary. I'm not going to read it line by line, but I'd like to read it through. I've given you, in the English, two things. I've given you a translation of the text, and I've given you a list of passages from Chumash which are relevant to the interpretation of the text. That is to say, other passages in Torah, or passages in Torah, that might be of value. I apologize if people would have wanted to have it in Hebrew. It was more convenient for me to put it together in English. And therefore, you have that as well, stapled together with the English translation. And as we go through, what I'd like to do, and with your help and agreement, is to comment on... I'm not even going to tell you what kind of text this is yet. I want to read the text, and let's see, what is this person writing about? What is he thinking about? And, of course, what kind of problems is he responding to? And I think if we can answer some of those questions, we can then come and make an intelligent statement about what this is. Yes, I've called the lecture A New Commentary on Bereshit, so you all know the answer. But let's see what led me to that conclusion, a very new kind of text. Okay, the first couple of lines... Bishnat arba meot ushmonim lechaye Noach, ba kitzam leNoach. Velokim amar lo yadur ruchi ba'adam leolam veyechatchu yemehem mea esrim shana ad kets me mabul. Unit one. Right, in the 480th year of life of Noach, their end or their time came to Noach, seeing that God had said, my spirit shall not dwell in man forever, and their days shall be fixed at 120 years until the time of the flood. Now, it just seems to be a statement. Is it an interpretation? Is it a comment? Yes. On what? It's a comment on the number 120. The Torah says in Breshit Vav Pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Hashem lo yadon ruchi. Yadon is a unique word. He has yadur here. I'm not going to talk about yadur versus yadon. I wrote an independent article about it. If anybody wants to know, I'll be happy to refer them to it. That's not the issue we're dealing with. Lo yadur ruchi ba'adam leolam bishagam hu basar v'hayu yamav me'av esrim shana. Now, you know that there are two ways to interpret v'hayu yamav me'av esrim shana. Either that the lifespan of man is going to be limited in the future to 120 years, and you actually find this interpretation in Breshit Rabbah, you find it in Josephus, you find it in a work by Pseudo-Philo with the first century CE, so it's attested in early interpretation, or the amount of time remaining for tshuva, for repentance, until the flood is 120 years. This interpretation is found also in Breshit Rabbah, as well as in all the Aramaic Targumim on this Pasuk. But there are two ways to interpret. Clearly, by situating this call of God in the 480th year of Noach's life, it's clear that he interprets 120 years to be the time remaining until the flood. But that forces him to do something irregular and to highlight it. Because after all, we are told a few psukim earlier in Sefer Bereishit, Perek Hei Pasuk Lamed Beit, Vayichi Noach Chamesh Meot Shana, Vayoled Noach Et Shem Et Cham Et Yafet. Noah lived 500 years and then had his three sons. Wait a minute. Yet this pasuk, we are told, now comes in the 480th year of the life of Noah. And here already the commentator here, and notice this is a different kind of perush. It's not going to ask questions and answers. You can just visualize how a medieval mefaresh might have set it up. And what would the medieval mefaresh, assuming he was not Ramban, what would he have said, Rashi or Ibn Ezra, about this order, assuming they accepted the analysis? They would have said, Ein Mukdam Umu'uchar Batorah. And that is what our interpreter from Qumran is saying, in effect. By specifying the date in Noach's life, knowing full well a few psukim earlier he was 500, he's telling us, highlight, it's 120 years to the flood, and don't worry about what looks to be this contradiction. Make sure you interpret it in this fashion. For me, this is pshat parshanut of a very basic level. You highlight the difficulty as you answer it. You do both at one time. You highlight the ein mukdam u'uchar as you explain it. And of course, along the way, he is giving us an interpretation of what that 120 years means, taking a stand between the two positions which are alternative. Is this unique to a Qumran interpreter? Not necessarily. The question is a question that any reader of Torah is going to read. It's not a question that only someone who is thinking about those funny things that those people at the Dead Sea Caves are thinking about could ask. The next passage is very long, and I don't want to take you through it line by line. Let me describe what we have in it. The next passage runs from line 3, from Umei HaMabul, all right, through the next column, line 5, the first word as we end L'moed Shana Tamima. Now, in this passage, we find a focus, and here I will admit that I may be forcing the issue when I claim this is not typical of the Dead Sea group, because we know that the Dead Sea group is very concerned with issues of calendar. And if I'm going to argue this is a pshat commentary, in theory, I don't want anything in it which is introduced by a prejudicial frame of reference, by a frame of reference which is unique to one kind of commentary and not another. And I believe I can even push it here, but I want to admit that I am going to be pushing it a little bit at this point. What I do have, however, is a chronology of the Mabul. And you know, if you've studied Parashat Noach, that the counting of the days of the Mabul does have a couple of questions here and there. There are a couple of awkwardnesses in terms of how you count the days. I mean, if you count 5 months and 150 days, if you're counting, 150 days, it's not exactly that length. You expect it to be a day or two more, perhaps. There are stresses on certain things here, like the days of the week. And each time we're given a piece of the story, we're told that something is, for example, in line 7, that Ad Yom Esrim Shisha B'Chodesh HaShlishi Yom Chamisha B'Shabbat Vayigbru HaMayim Al Haaretz Chamishimum At Yom 150 days Ad Yom Arba'a Asar B'Chodesh HaShvi'i B'Shlosha B'Shabbat. And with 150 days, he counts it out. Then he adds 2 days very cleverly in order to make the chronology work. Ubisof chamishim umaat yom chasru hamayim shnei yamim yom harviv yom hachamishi. He needs that Wednesday and Thursday for the chronology that he's going to count through a whole year of 364 days. He needs the 2 days, but it's not pushing pshat. It may be legitimately within the psukim. Then uvayom yom hashishi nacha hateval hare horarat hu yom shiva asar b'chodesh hashvii. And, of course, we have the beginning of the waters then diminishing. You notice in each case, we're getting the date. Is it Sunday? Nothing is happening on Shabbos. Shabbat is excluded in the system of this group, these interpreters. Shabbat is excluded from any kind of activity recorded in the Bible. very, very carefully, and you'll notice he works the days out, and it comes out that way. This is, again, perhaps typical, but the problem that he's dealing with is, how do I count out the year? And he goes through it little by little. He sends out the dove on a Sunday. It comes back. He waits again. He sends it out again, and so on and so forth. And you'll notice he's using mostly the language of the Torah. What you have here, and this is what I had commented on earlier, remember I said in early on you wrote commentaries by rewriting the text, including your interpretation. And it's called, as a genre, it's called rewritten Bible. That may very well be what you have here, because I don't know how this commentary came to be. To be very honest, it's my belief that the author of this commentary picked and chose from other things to create this new thing called commentary. Part of what he was choosing from was the old-fashioned interpretation where I rewrote the whole story, which is why he's giving you this very lengthy, discursive discussion of the Noach material. It could have been done much faster if you hadn't chosen to write it out. That's why if you read it, you'll feel that you're reading the text of the Torah with slight adjustments for the purpose of interpretation. And this is very, very typical of the way interpretation was done in the period of Bayit Sheni, I think, as a whole. Please. Hebrew. This is Hebrew. There are works from Qumran in Aramaic. This is Hebrew, and you can taste the language of Torah underneath it. It's virtually quotations, and if you compare, you know, the English of the parallel text on the last page of the English with the English of the translation of the manuscript, you can see these things are fairly close together. All that the author of the commentary has done is filled in some of the holes in the text. What has he done? He's answered the questions that you might be asking. He's given you the answers, again, without asking the questions. This is not the way Perush comes to be written later, but it's very typical for that period. Yeah. I should be... He's a ringer. He heard this lecture in class last year, so his question is likely to be very sophisticated. No. No, it's a commentary. If he is not attempting to rewrite the Torah. The Torah is canonical and sacred for the people at Qumran. They believe in it, and they were extremely devout and pious individuals who took good care of their Sfarim, and they believed in their Torah, and they did do funny things, and they wrote other things, but they were not going to tamper with the Torah. They might write something else and tell you that it was just important as the Torah, but they were not going to tamper with the text. I mean, they might write the Temple Scroll, but they're not going to play around with it. They're not going to play around with it here. And you can see here in the course of the narrative of the Mabul, which really, as I said, is primarily a whole series of calendrical details, very much the Book of Yovlim, Sefer Yovlim, the Book of Jubilees, is the same kind of concern, four things calendrical. Yasher Kochacha, thank you. And the author of this text, whoever he was, or the copyist, or the collector, puts this material together in a way that you can read this together. Let's say you sit with your Chumash, in our terms, in one hand, and this in your other hand, and as you read the Chumash and have a problem, you look at the comment, and he solves it for you. That's not how he meant for you to read it, but one could use it that way. Yeah. Yeah. I passed around the picture. The Noach material, the first two lines, or first two and a half, if you have the picture there, and there's some of them, I don't have any more of the very big ones, so I can't use them to demonstrate. The Noach material is all of this column, and you have virtually all of it. If you push it together, you can actually read virtually the entire column, as well as here. Now, here you have the first couple of lines, and it gets cut off, right? So, as we go further down, you have less of the text, but the Noach material is virtually complete. They spell it Lamed Vav Aleph. That's a Qumran scribal peculiarity. I will put it to you this way. In Qumran writing, they have a tendency to write very, very Malay. However, it's not 100%. And this manuscript is probably too short to study the percentages. There's not enough of it. You're absolutely right. When we have a long text, we want to know how much did they write Malay, how much did they write Chaser, and believe it or not, something as minor and insignificant as that may have very important things to tell us about where are they copying the manuscript from and who's writing it. In a manuscript that's as short as this one and as fragmentary as this one, it's very dangerous to try to draw conclusions, but your question is very much in place. I just don't have an answer. Notice, and I'll make a final comment about the calendar and we'll move on to more interesting things. Notice that Noah comes out according to this text in the Hebrew in column 2. Leketz Shanat Mimali Amim Shlosh Meot Shishim Va'arba'a, line 3 of column 2. Be'achad Bashabat B'shiva Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da Now, without getting involved in a discussion, the date is different from the date it is in the Torah. But they had a solar calendar, the Torah has a lunar calendar. In the Torah, he comes out 1 year and 10 days later, which is approximately 354 lunar days plus 10, 364 days. Expressed in their terms of a calendar, it's a Shana Shlema. And without getting involved in detail, they are particularly interested in the year being perfect, 364 days, 52 weeks, 7 days each. Every Yom Tov comes out the same day every year, and you know that after 30 years, Pesach will be a month earlier. How they dealt with that is a subject for yet another lecture. Let's turn back to the text and some interesting commentary. Line 5. Vayiketz Noach Miyeno, Vayeda et asher asa lo benoach katon. This is a quotation to God. Noach wakes up, he knows what his younger son has done to him. Vayomer, Arur Kena'an, Eved Avadim Yehiye Le'echav. Cursed be Kena'an, may he be a lowly slave to his brothers. Comment. That's a dibur hamatchil. Now a comment. V'lo kilel et cham, he didn't curse Cham, who actually did it, ki im beno, but rather his son. Ki beirach el et b'nei Noach, because God had already blessed the sons of Noach. Therefore, the commentator says, and it's a question that everybody asks, why does Noach curse Kena'an, the son of Cham, when it's Cham who did whatever he did? And the answer given, and it's a wonderful answer, I'll tell you where else you find it in a second, the answer that's given is a wonderful answer. What is it? Cham was already blessed. God blessed Noach and his sons when they came out of the Teva. Therefore, there's nothing Noach can do to Cham. All he can do is curse his son. Let me quote you from Bereshit Rabbah, the Midrash that I spoke of earlier. Quoting the same pasuk, Vayomer Arur Kena'an Eved Avadim Yehiye Le'echav. Atmeha. Question. Cham chotei uchna'an mitkalel? Cham sins and Kena'an is cursed. I'd rather read this right. Rabbi Huda, Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Huda Omer, Lefi shekatuv vayivarech Elohim et Noach veet panav ve'ein klala bimkom bracha lefichach vayomer Arur Kena'an. Remarkable. Several hundred years later, written down in Midrash Rabbah. I don't have the same words, but close enough to the same words that when I saw it for the first time, I said, ooh. Exactly the same question and exactly the same answer. And there's no need for a connection between them. I have no need to say, as much as I'd like to say, and you see, I have a masorah that this is the answer. This is a pshat answer. This is an answer that any one of us could have come up with from reading the Chumash. And unfortunately, when I have that kind of an answer, I don't allow myself to claim that there has to be a connection between the two statements. Surely. Cham sins and Kena'an is cursed. Rabbi Huda says, because the verse states, God blessed Noah and his sons, and there is no curse in the place of blessing, therefore he said, cursed be Canaan. Virtually the same type of language that we find in the Qumran text. And the text continues. The Qumran text. Uv'ahvi ohalei shem yishkon, eretz natan la'avraham ohavo. And he shall dwell in the tents of shame, the land which he gave to Avraham, his friend. Well, very strange. I know I have later on in that same section, Yaftalokim liyefet v'yishkon ba'olei shem. And here I have again a dispute. May God enlarge Yefet, and may he dwell in the tents of shame. Excuse me, who is he who is going to dwell in the tents of shame? Is it Yefet should dwell in the tents of shame? Or God should dwell in the tents of shame? And here too, this is a subject about which there is dispute in even rabbinic sources in Breishit Rabbah. One view says it refers to God. The other view says it refers to Yefet. So, again, there are two possibilities. And this, again, if I'm learning these psukim, if I'm sitting and studying these psukim with my 9-year-old son, he's going to ask me, who is he? Who is Yishkon? Is God going to dwell or is it Yefet? And let me tell you something. My 9-year-old son asks questions like that. Keeps me on my toes. So I have to answer the question. It's a question, again, as I want to stress, that any reader of the text is going to ask. What is the answer given by the author of our document from Qumran? He says, Eretz Natan the Torah. What the Torah tells us is that Avram is born when Terach is 70 years old. And it says they went from Ur Kasdim, they went to Haran, they lived in Haran for a while, Terach dies in Haran. How old is Avraham when he leaves Haran? He's 75 years old. That's a pasuk in the beginning of Parshat Lech Lecha. Va'avram ben shivim ben chamesh v'shivim shana b'tzeito me'charan. That's our background for the passage we're now looking at. Terach is 140 years old when he left Ur Kasdim. I say, huh? That's strange. Va'yavo Haran, and he came to Haran. Va'avram ben shivim shana, period. This is why everybody got this wrong, because you look at Avram and you see shivim shana v'chamesh shanim, and you want to put it together, and it makes no sense if you run it together. Obviously, if Avram is born when Terach is 70, so when Terach is 140, Avram is 70. V'chamesh shanim yashav Avram b'charan. And Avram remained in Haran 5 years. Well, that we know because the Torah says he was 75 when he left. Ve'achar yatsa. And here I will give you my filling in. Avram el Eretz Kena'an shishim shana meit Terach. And 60 years after Avram left to go to Eretz Kena'an, Terach died. And that's nothing more than the arithmetic of 205 minus 60 is 145. It's clear Terach is 145 when Avram leaves, because it's 140 plus 5. This is simple arithmetic. I'm not up to the hard stuff yet. That's simple. I got a blackboard. Good. That's the simple arithmetic. Terach is 145 when Avram leaves. 60 years later, he's 205 and he dies. A parenthetical statement by our author. But wait a minute. What makes him say Terach leaves when he's 140 years old and lives for 5 years in Haran? Lives for 5 years in Haran. And now, let me in. And here, it is my view that the author of this text knows his biblical chronology. We've seen in earlier passages that one of the things that excites this author is calculations of the years and the dates and making sure everything works out very, very nice. You all know that there is a contradiction between two statements in the Torah. It's very well known. We've maybe even run across it recently in the Parshiot that we've just read. There's a statement that Bnei Yisrael are going to spend how many years in Galut? 400. Right? 400. That's what's told to Abraham at the time of Brit Ben Habitarim. We count 400 years from when? From the birth of Yitzchak. However, there's another number that's given at the time of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. We're told that Bnei Yisrael have been in Egypt for how long? How long has it been? Oh no, not that. Forget 210 for the moment. I got another number for you. 430 years. We can't deal with the 210 at the moment. We'll just worry about 400 versus 430.
How do Chazal respond to this 430 years? After all, if this 430 counts from Brit Bein HaBetarim, which is the way Chazal work it out, so how old is Avram when Brit Bein HaBetarim takes place? He's 70. Well, he's 100 when Yitzchak is born. Okay? So Avram is 70. Which means, how old... When did Brit Bein HaBetarim take place? It's in the middle of Lech Lecha. When did it actually take place? Before the beginning of Lech Lecha. It's one of the famous Ein Mukdam U'Mu'uchars. And you have to say, according to this interpretation, which is the standard interpretation you'll find in Seder Olam Rabbah, the standard Bina chronology, you'll find it all over the place in Chazal, that Avram went to Eretz Yisrael twice. He went when he was 70, he had the Brit Bein HaBetarim, he went back to Haran, and he goes to Haran when he's 75. And this is the standard Chazal solution to the contradiction. Comes along our author and says, nothing doing. Avram is 70 years old when he leaves Ur Kasdim. And I will tell you, he's not saying this explicitly, but there's no doubt in my mind, very little anyway, that this is what he's thinking about. If Avram leaves home at age 70, we count 430 years from the time Avram begins his wandering. And Avram begins his wandering when he's 70. And that's why we get this artificial, seemingly, date pulled out of the air. Terach is 140, Avram is 70. Why? Because he needs it to solve a pshat chronological problem. He's not going to go with the midrashic answer that Avram made two trips. And I will, parenthetically, it's very interesting, this interpretation remains hidden for a very, very long time. But should any of you be interested, this interpretation is also found in, come on, where is it? Rav Sadia Gaon, Ibn Ezra, and Rabbi Yosef Bechor Shor, one of the students of Rashi's students, three important Mefarshim in the Middle Ages, come up with the same logic. You count 430 from the time he left Haran, and it's interesting, the Gra, the Gaon of Vilna, in a comment on Seder Olam, claims that he saw such an interpretation in a midrash. Neither I nor anybody else who has looked for it has succeeded in finding such a midrash. But the medieval Mefarshim have it. There are other sources for it, late sources. But here we have, perhaps in the 1st or 2nd century BCE, a commentator who shows us he's thinking about these issues. If anybody has a different, can come up with a different reason of why to pick the number 70, and the, you know, please tell it to me, because in my mind, I think it's clinched. The arithmetic works out. You've solved the 430-400 problem. I don't have to resort to the drash of Chazal saying that Avram went to Eretz Yisrael twice, which is not mentioned in the Psukim. As a result, once again, we see the type of parshanut that I might find in a medieval Mefaresh, and as I said, Sadia Ibn Ezra Bechor Shor, three of the great Pashtanim of the Middle Ages, coming along to solve the very same question using the very, very same calculation, the very, very same arithmetic. Sure. Okay, if Avram leaves Haran when he's 70, then that's 430 years before Geulat Mitzrayim. Yitzchak's birth is 400 years before. Avram is 100 when Yitzchak is born. So if Avram is 70, I've got my 30 years there in the interim. So by having Avram leave home specifically at age 70, he has started his wanderings, as it were, at a point exactly 430 years before Galut Mitzrayim, and I believe that's the reason he comes up with the calculation. It solves the problem. I'm sorry, he leaves Ur Kasdim. He leaves his birthplace at 70. He leaves Ur Kasdim. Haran, he leaves 5 years later, as the Torah states. Now, there are a few... Yeah. The Torah says he's 75 when he leaves Haran. No, it's 70, he's 75 when he... Yeah, that's correct. The Torah says he's 75. It is 5 years later if you assume it's 70. And this is, again, this is a clever interpretation. It's an insightful interpretation.
You can't prove it right or wrong, but it does help us in solving another kind of problem within the Torah. There are a couple of other, again, there's no doubt that this commentary, as I said, is very fragmentary. There isn't a lot that I can say about some of the middle passages. I want to look at top of column 4, which is bottom of that, page 34, a very unusual comment. Timnahi tapi legesh lalifaz ben esav ateled lo et amalek. A comment on a pasuk out of the blue. By the way, it's clear since we have all these comments that this commentary did not cover Breshit perek by perek. If you count it out, there's a great deal of selectivity, which is one of the things that leads me to call it a commentary. By definition, a commentator picks and chooses what he wants to talk about. If you're rewriting the story, you have to rewrite the whole story. Whereas a commentator picks and chooses what he wants to say something about and what he wants to leave out. And look how he defines this. Amalek, hu asher hikash Shaul, ka'asher diber lemoshe, ba'acharit hayamim timche et zecher Amalek mitachat hashamayim. We're not too far from Parshat Zachor. And the mention of Amalek comes out of the blue in the genealogy of Esav. Presumably, our author asked himself the following question. Why does the Torah bother telling me about the Pilegesh of Esav and about the child which this Pilegesh had? Doesn't seem to be particularly relevant. And our author comes and tells us that this is going to be important later on. Rashbam has a notion that sometimes the Torah gives us information in advance before we need it, so when it comes up, we'll have the information. He says it on V'cham Hu Avi Kenan, as a matter of fact. And here, too, our manuscript gives us information about Amalek and says, Shaul is going to defeat him later on. As God said to Moshe, in Acharit HaYamim, you're going to wipe out Amalek completely. Here, I think there are two things going on. First of all, Amalek is important because of the war with Shaul. But notice that he's changed the mitzvah. The mitzvah in the Torah says, as soon as you rest in Eretz Yisrael, you are supposed to wipe out Amalek. He changes it to, Ba'acharit HaYamim, timche et zecher Amalek. It's almost as if he's apologizing for why Shaul didn't do it, because there was no mitzvah for Shaul to do it. The mitzvah of Mechiyat Amalek is Acharit HaYamim. I may be darshaning here, but I think... Okay. Usually does. Okay. I don't think so. I will tell you that you're in very good company in making that suggestion. I will tell you that I think Acharit HaYamim at Qumran means Acharit HaYamim. I forget whether Amalek still exists or not. The Rambam's there, right? After it's clear because Amalek, even after Shaul, if you remember, you have an Amaleki at the time of Shaul's death. As a matter of fact, you know, you're not Amaleki. You have Amalekim, you know, still floating around in the time of. In his day, I don't know. I think not. It's coming, but I don't know. In other words, it's conceivable he could have thought that. I don't know if he's thinking about it, because I don't know if we have any references in all of Bayit Sheni literature, and here I would have to say, I don't know, I'd have to check, to see whether anybody at all is thinking about the contemporary existence of Amalek. If I were to find such sources, I think your point would be very well taken. I simply don't know whether anybody assumes there are any Amaleki left around. But it's not inconceivable. Now, your comment is certainly possible. There is an argument that I've been involved in, and I just sent off something where I get involved in a disagreement. And I really believe Acharit HaYamim means the end of days. No, Timche. Maybe. I mean, I'm willing to be argued with. I wish I hadn't said it as strongly in the articles I've written about it, but I've stuck my neck out, so I'll keep it out. I sense that Mechiyat Amalek, the way he understands it, is projected in something in the future, or at least in the future past Shaul, at least, and the time of Shaul. I don't believe the time of Shaul is Acharit HaYamim. That's for certain. And this is where I disagree with some others. If there are days after Acharit HaYamim, there certainly might be. No, the people of Amalek. You mean the person Amalek, not the nation? That is, you know, I've never given that any thought. That's very interesting. That I have to think about. Make a note to myself that who should. I don't. You'd expect it to refer to a person. But I don't believe that it does. But no. But earlier, when he says "Vatelad lo tamalek," who asher hikas Shaul, as opposed to "Hey masher hikas Shaul." He. That's that. I'm not sure whether you aren't reading too hard, but it's worth thinking. I mean, it's a good question. It's a good point. Oh, ha'am asher hikas. Ha'am asher hikas. It could be. But then again, he could have made it clearer. Two very quick comments, and I'll sort of try to pull it together and answer any questions which you might have. There is a quick. You notice there's a heading Birchot Yaakov in line 3. It's almost as if there's a heading on the section, Birchot Yaakov. And in the fragments of the last sections, it's clear that we're dealing through the next three columns with Birchot Yaakov. Unfortunately, most of it's missing. A reference to Reuven. And what does he say about Reuven? He quotes the whole pasuk of the bracha of Reuven's misbehavior. Pishro, and here he uses a Qumran word. It's interpretation, it's pesher. Asher hochicho, because he rebuked him. Asher shachavim bilha pilagsho, because he lay with Bilha his concubine. The Amar and so on. Why is Yaakov saying this not nice thing to Reuven? Because of his behavior with Bilha. Remember, back in Parshat Vayishlach, the Torah tells us that Reuven lay with Bilha, or messed up her bed, if you want to read Chazal, right? One or the other. Clearly he misbehaved. Yet Yaakov doesn't do anything. The Torah tells us that Yaakov heard about it, and Yaakov saves it up for later. I think that may be the intent of the remark here also. This tochacha is the tochacha which really belonged back there, hochicho, because of what he did earlier at the beginning. If not, it's a peculiar statement, because for us it should be obvious why hochicho. Maybe, however, for the reader of Breishit in the time of the composer of this, it wasn't so obvious. And that's why he has to take him by the hand and say, please remember, there was a Pilegesh, remember what Reuven did, and that's why Yaakov is saying these things to him. It's a fairly straightforward comment. Finally, a Qumran-like passage, and all of a sudden we come to Yehuda, and he starts to talk the language of Qumran, not the language that I like to hear, the language of Pshat. He quotes the Bracha and starts to interpret it in terms very typical of Qumran literature generally. Nothing else here, maybe the chronology, well, the first chronology was typical. Here I have Lo yikaret Yoshev kisei l'David, Hamechokei ki brit malchut, Alfei Yisrael hema hadigalim, Ad bo Mashiach hatzedek, Tzemach David. Tzemach David is a branch Davidian, is a typical Qumran term for the Mashiach, at least the Mashiach from Yehuda. They have two Mashiachim, Aharon v'Yisrael. And once I hear terms like Tzemach David, and then in the next line I have Anshei HaYachad, the men of the community, that already puts me in a real Qumran context. No longer does he seem to be interpreting, and this, by the way, was the first passage to be published, and because of this passage, it was called Pesher Breishit, because this is much more typical of the kind of interpretation that I get in the Psharim than anything else in this manuscript. It was named on the basis of the first passage published. This is unusual, and there's no doubt in my mind that the way this piece of commentary differs from the rest. On the other hand, you could say, no, it's a prophetic text. All prophetic texts, any text of a nevuah nature, needs special Pesher-type interpretation. Because after all, what a Navi says is never to be taken at face value. You have to interpret it. So if I really want to push it, I'll tell you this is their pshat of a Navi was a Pesher, but I don't really believe it. So what do we have? We have a text which goes through in six short columns Sefer Breishit, picking and choosing the material in it. I could give you a list of the prakim which are included. I must have it written down somewhere. The number of I'll tell you the prakim that are included. Breishit 6, 7, 8, 9, 11, 15, 16, 18, 22, 28, 35, and 49. And that's if you include even those fragmentary bits. And you say, if I see a piece of a pasuk, I count that perek. That's the sum and total of the material from Breishit that's covered in this text. That's why it's not a rewritten Bible. It's not a narrative. It's also primarily not a commentary which is uniquely linked to the beliefs and ideas of the group which lived at Qumran. It's a commentary, most of whose comments could be made by anybody who's studying Torah and reading the text and saying, hey, I've got a problem, what does this mean? Whether it's the problem of what the 120 years means, or the problem of the 430-400 years of Shibud Mitzrayim, or if it's the problem of why Cham is not getting a curse and Kana'an is, and so on and so forth. All of these kinds of issues are problems that anybody would want to answer. Why the author is picking and choosing in this way, what leads him to be interested in certain questions and not others, is something that unfortunately we can't answer. It's clear that he has an interest in chronology, that one of the things that seems to pop up are problems about chronology. The question of how, and I would put this text, I would call it the beginnings of pshat-type parshanut, the beginnings of trying to write about Torah Shebichtav, answering questions without the rewriting of the whole story. There's a long way to go from this to Rashi or Sadia or Ibn Ezra. I don't mean that we go right there. But this, to me, this kind of text, is a very new kind of document in the ancient world. It's new for scholars of ancient literature because we really haven't had this kind of thing. It's new for us because we see an earlier link in terms of the history of how Jews have studied Torah Shebichtav. We can't always link to it in a very close way. We simply don't have enough information. But by defining it as a commentary, by focusing on the mode of interpretation, on the problems which the author of the text had, and on what in the Torah stimulated those problems, by looking at the stimulation as opposed to the results, we see that we have here the beginning of commentary. It's not a full commentary. I think the author wrote it by picking and choosing from other works. That's why it starts in the middle of a sentence. I think he started by borrowing a sentence. It started in the middle, and that's the way it goes. But this text is, as far as I know, a contribution to the history of Pshuto Shel Mikra interpretation. In Jewish history, in Jewish tradition, we really find no other commentaries of this type until the Middle Ages. And in this way, this text is something very, very new and very, very interesting. And I'll be happy to answer your questions about it. Please. I don't... God's choosing what? So I get this feeling I've just been blindsided. No, I haven't been, because George Brooks says the same thing. And I will tell you that along the lines which you have suggested... is indeed the approach to this text, which has been taken by certain other students, particularly by Brooke, who is the editor of the text, who begins with what I would call a theological reading. It has the advantage over my approach of attempting to suggest a unity to the document, which I'm not ready to find. On the other hand, however, there is too much of what I call interpretation going on here, too much of the kind of close reading of the text that I'm not sure how I would make these two things go together, because I'm convinced that I've got my pshat commentary. I hear what you're saying, and I like the way you formulated it. I think you may have actually formulated it better than he did. The notion of, you know, rejections and choices and rejections. That's a theme which, in a certain sense, the Torah itself has, though. After all, Hevel gets, you know, Cain gets rejected, Shet gets picked, Noach gets picked from everybody else, Shem gets picked out of B'nai Noach, Avram gets picked out of B'nai Shem, and so on down the line. So one could suggest, and I don't want to dispose of your question this way, but to a certain degree, this reading grows organically out of the story of the Torah itself. And I'd have to look more closely, and here I'd want to look at some of those in-between pieces where we don't really have a good sense of what's there. But I'm not sure that it will carry out throughout. On the other hand, and here I will very much, I appreciate the comment, I'd like to dance at both chatunot. I'd like to have my cake and eat it. I'd like both of us to be right. But I don't know how I can claim that it is the kind of commentary which I genuinely think that it is, and then say, oh, he just happened to write simple sense commentary on passages which create a certain pattern. I haven't worked out yet how to make those two run smoothly together. But your suggestion that what's going on here is a series of choices, by the way, for them, the culmination would be Levi, not Yehuda. Because in their belief, generally at Qumran, you have a two Mashiach system, Mashiachei Aaron v'Yisrael, and the Mashiach of Levi outranks the Mashiach of Yehuda. So it isn't quite culmination. But like, somebody actually said that, and I pointed out that if that were the culmination, then we wouldn't have another column of text after it. There's clearly text which goes to some of the brachot of the brothers afterwards, and if that really were meant to be the culmination, then you have an anticlimax following it. So it's clear that the parshanun aspect is dominant, even though I think that there may be some real merit in your suggestion, and I'm going to give it some further thought. But you should have stopped at that point. There shouldn't have been anything after Yehuda if the goal is to show that, you know, the rejection of everything Yehuda is going to be the high point. I think Levi is not afterwards. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Levi... you can't tell. There's another one of the interesting things. There's another one of the other partners to this text, 253 or 254, has other brachot in it. The texts are not related. It just happens to have brachot of other sons of Yaakov, and there's no overlap of sons between the two texts. And we don't know how to deal with it. But if I'm not mistaken, there is a bracha of Levi in the other one. And let's face it, he's going in order. So, as far as we can tell. Except that he's doing the brachot in order. You notice he started with Reuven, and he's got Yisachar later on. So he should have ended with Yehuda and Levi. I mean, he's following the order. The organizational principle of the document of his Perush is Torah. And he's following the order there. So he's bound to it in a certain, you know, to a certain degree. I mean, I think your point, though, has, you know, it really has merit. You have a question over here? Yeah. A test? That's cute. I would, if you ask me, I'm more likely to be somebody's personal notes rather than a test. I mean, if, you know, that's somebody. No, oh, wait. Remember. Okay. Let me make the following point. We tend to think of books as things published. You put them out for people to read. That's a modern phenomenon. People then, for all we know, may very well have been writing things for themselves or to share with their, you know, a small circle of friends. The notion of writing something which people are going to read may not apply to something like this. And this is one of the questions that I raised when I started by saying when we look at a text, we don't have... I'll read a quote from a well-known literary scholar. Without helpful orientations like titles and attributions,
readers are likely to gain widely different generic conceptions of a text, and these conceptions will be constitutive of their subsequent understanding. That means, if I pick up a text without a first page, without a title, without an author, without even a name of what kind of text it is, my presuppositions are going to affect the way I read the whole text. This text has the problem that it doesn't tell us what it is. And therefore, I think there are a variety of hypotheses that we could come up with for what this kind of text is. But I think it would be very, very hard to give an answer which I know is going to be right and all the other ones are going to be wrong. Sure. Oh, there's no doubt that I'm not surprised that this text was written at Qumran. What I'm saying is, even the kind of commentary, Qumran texts, for example, very often have polemic. They have nasty comments about their opponents. They're full of a certain animosity, especially when they're sectarian. This text doesn't have anything like that. In other words, if you ask me, it may very well have been written by somebody at Qumran, somebody whose thinking was shaped by Qumran, but it doesn't have a heavy dosage of sectarian decoration. I would think it's early. If you ask me, in terms of the chronology of Qumran, that might very well put it at an earlier date before everything took on a much heavier dosage. I would agree with that. If I didn't say it in class, I'll say it now, and I'll agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. No, they're not leaving out. It's we're missing the bottom of the column. Well, look at column 4. Yudas, column 5. Look at column 4 through line 7. We're still in Reuven in line 7 of column 4. So short brachot for Levi and Shimon and Levi could very easily fill out the rest of column 4. And column 5 would begin with Yehuda. Notice column 6... Right? Naphtali, you have the word Shefer in line 2, which is probably Naphtali. So it would appear that in column 6 already, you have Asher and Naphtali. But I don't think it's being left out. I think even that is simply still going to be following the sequence in the, you know, in the Torah. Okay, I think it's a library of a community. However, it's a library of a community to which people who joined the community probably brought their own books, which means you have halakha books which contradict each other in that library. But then again, you can go into a library and you might find the Rama and the Mechaber on the same page in disagreement. In other words, you know, the notion of disagreement, there's a lot of flexibility in what people are reading. But I really believe that the heavy concentration of material which is, I will call, sectarian or Qumranic or unique to the practices and beliefs of that group makes me feel that I can't pull it away from them. However, they may have also been reading many other things which were not written only by people who belong to their group. Who were they? That's a subject for, you know, a variety of other things. I mean, Larry Schiffman has argued that they're the Sadducees of a certain kind. I think he's partly right. On the other hand, I want to know why they look like Essenes. When you look at some of the works, they look like pious Sadducees. If you look at other works, they look like Essenes. And you know what? We're not finished with this. It'll take us a good while in terms of studying these texts. You know, now that so much more stuff has been published and we have the opportunity to read this material, it's going to take us a little bit longer till we have all the answers. Maybe I'll come back sometime and give you... Actually, I'm coming back in 2 weeks to tell you a little bit about halakha in some of these texts. So we'll have a chance then. Okay?